Son, and the Torah doesn't go into too much detail concerning the 12 sons of Yaakov. Mainly, who would you say is the most significant one of the Joseph? Joseph is a major figure in Bereishis. To a certain extent, of course, Yehuda plays a major role. Yeah, Binyamin, but it doesn't go into too much about his activities. We encounter Shimon and Levi. They take revenge, right? They save their sister Dina from captivity. But Reuben, I find Reuben to be a very interesting individual to study. What is it that attracts our attention? What's the first thing that we notice as being significant about Reuben? What comes to mind? Thank you. Okay. He is the Bechor, he's the firstborn. And therefore, that leads to something which is very interesting. Because he's the pro. Yes?
I think that
he really does not. He loses out on the rights that he would have been entitled to in the development of the Jewish people. He does. What he does at the end, when Yaakov gives the blessing to the 12 sons, so it's quite clear that Yeser Se'et, the Yeser Az, right? Let's take a look. Let's begin with that then. The fact of the matter is that somehow he failed. We'll start with Vayechi. All right. Chapter 49 is a very significant chapter. It talks about the last will, so to speak, last testament, the brachos that Jacob gave to his 12 sons. Right? Does everybody have a place? Chapter 49. Yaakov called to his sons and said, "Gather around and I will tell you that which will occur to you in the end of days. Gather around and listen, sons of Jacob, and listen to your father Israel." Now he starts off with Reuven. Reuven, you are my Bechor, my firstborn, my power and strength. Now, Yeser Se'ez, the Yeser Az. What does that mean, Yeser? More Se'ez is like position or dignity or glory, so to speak. And more power. What does it mean? It's like an incomplete sentence. Anybody have the English translation? Can you give me that? Lori? Yeah. Rashi says to Ace, Roy Hoyiso Lios Yeser Alechicha. You were fit. You should have had more than your brothers, the kahuna. It's a reference to the kahuna. Losho Nisias Kapayim. To Ace is to raise the hand. So the kahana would raise their hands. In other words, he's informing him indirectly, in a nice way, that since he was the firstborn, he would have been entitled to certain positions of importance in the people, and he's not going to have them. And then he says, "V'yeser oz b'malchus." Really, you should have had the kingship as well. The term oz is strength, power. Umi garm l'chala hasid kalela. What caused you to lose all this? In other words, ideally, this is a transition point. Each of the 12 sons became the leaders of the tribes, of the 12 tribes, and each of the 12 tribes had a function in the nation. So, as the firstborn, he should have been the one to have had the two major positions of influence in the nation, which would have been the kahuna, and which would have been the malchut. So then he's going to lose it all. That's a big loss. So what's the reason? The next pasuk says, "Pachas kamayim al tosar." But quick as water, just like water is very quick. And Rashi says, "Pachas and bahala," like you acted with quickness and in a state of turmoil, like a state of emotional turmoil. He's alluding to some problem, some defect that he has. You've lost it. You will not have more. And what's the reason? Can you translate that, please, Lori? Number four.
Because you're unstable of water, you no longer can.
Okay. Now, does that make any sense? Don't figure that one out. We see from here, I mean, clearly established that by right, he should have been entitled to these positions, but he lost them due to the fact that he was quick as water. We'll have to translate that. He acted very rashly, very hastily, very speedily. And what did he do? He moved the bed of his father. So let's get to that incident. Chapter 35, Panta Chafalos. Chaf Beis, actually. Vayhi Vishkon Yisrael Baratahi, and it was when Israel, that's Yaakov, dwelt in this land. Vayelech Reuven, and Reuven went. Vayishkav Es Bilav Pilegesh Aviv. Now, literally, that would mean that he slept with Bilah, who was the concubine of his father. Vayishma Yisrael, and Israel heard. Vayivre Yaakov Shneimasar, and the sons of Yaakov were 12. They're very strange, very difficult. This is a very difficult area. What's going on over here? This means that, well, you can't understand this without Rashi. So let's turn to Rashi. Now, Rashi teaches us that it's not to be taken literally. It means he did not sleep with Bilhah. Mitosha Bilbel Mishkavo, because he moved the beds around. This is what Yaakov is referring to as the moving of the bed. Because he did that, the Torah considers it, attributed to him, as if he had slept with her. And why did he do it? Why did he do this? He said he acted for with good intentions, even though what he did was apparently a very serious sin. Why? Because when Rachel, his mother, when Rachel died, so what did Yaakov do? Yaakov took his bed, which was usually kept in the tent of Rachel. That's where he kept his bed. That was his bedroom, so to speak. And not in the other tent. So what did he do? He took it and he placed it in the tent of Bilhah. Now Bilhah was the Rachel's maiden, whom Rachel had given to him as a wife to have children with. Right? Because each one of the wives had a maid, so to speak, and each one had given their maid to Yaakov to have children. And Bilhah was the maid of, or the servant, whatever word you want to use, of Rachel, and Zilpah was the servant of Leah. So Reuben got involved in a situation over here which he should not have gotten involved in. So now it was a known thing. I mean, the Torah makes it very clear, we went through this, that Rachel was the favored wife of Yaakov. We explained that. In fact, we remember we said that he really did not hate Leah, but that's the way she experienced, because she had a need for his love, and she was deprived of his love, so she experienced it as though he had hated her. That's what we said. But we explained that there was absolutely nothing wrong with the fact that he respected Leah as a righteous individual, but he just did not love her. And there's nothing to do about anything like that. So therefore, this is okay. The fact of the matter is that his bed was, on a permanent basis, was kept in the tent of Rachel. Now, when Rachel died, what did Yaakov do? Yaakov moved his bed, and where did he move it? Did not move it into the tent of Leah. He moved it into the tent of Bilhah, who was the servant of Rachel. Yaakov wanted to move it there. He did move it there. He moved it there. He put it there. Now Reuben came, v'tova elbon imo, and he couldn't tolerate the injustice or the humiliation of his mother. He said, if the sister of my mother was a thorn, an antagonist, so to speak, to my mother, because she was the cause, the fact that apparently it bothered him that his mother was unhappy due to the fact that she didn't have the love of Yaakov. Now he's saying the servant of the sister of my mother should be a thorn or an antagonist to my mother? That he couldn't say. he felt it was unfair, it was unjust, that his mother had to put up with the fact that her sister was the favorite. But now that she's gone, he expected that his mother would become the prominent wife, the favored wife. That's what he expected. And therefore, he was upset. So he took the bed out of the tent of Bilhah, and he placed it in the tent of Leah. And that the Torah describes that. So in other words, this cannot be taken literally. Obviously, this would have been a terrible sin if it was on a literal level to actually sleep with her, the wife of his father, or concubine, whatever you want to say. But it was a wife, basically. So it's not meant to be taken literally, but nevertheless, we have to account for that. The Torah considers it to be such a serious crime that it actually considers it as though he had slept with her. It doesn't make sense. In other words, why? Whatever is wrong about what he did, let's assume we can understand he should not have done it. He should not have gotten involved in this, but why is it attributed to Zoe actually slept with her? Now, the Torah, that's why the prophet says, Vayiyu, and the sons of, what's the connection between this and the latter part of the pasuk, which says, and the sons of Israel were 12. What does it bring that in? Well, so Rashi explains that, Rashi says, to teach us that they were all equal, they were all righteous, that Reuven had not sinned. He's saying, in other words, the pasuk is pointing out, it's putting them all in one category, because if this were to be taken literally, then he'd be out of the group. He was a sinner, and he could not be included with the rest of them. So by telling us that the sons of Israel, who were all righteous men, were 12, it means that Reuven still is considered to be one of them, so he's still a tzaddik, he's still a righteous person. They didn't sin. In other words, he didn't do the action that the Torah is... Not, that don't take it literally, that's what it's talking about. Okay? So what I want to study is, where do you see, what is the defect of Reuven? That's what I'm really primarily concerned with. I'll try and explain what the reason why the Torah describes it this way, and what this particular sin, we'll try and explain that. But in the... Well, you see also, even in the blessings, although he criticizes Reuven, but he just takes away from him the special rights that he would have had, the additional rights that he would have had, but he doesn't cast him out of the nation. So he's not like someone like Esau, who was cast out of the Jewish, the future of the Jewish people. He will be a leader in Israel, but he just won't have the rights that he would have had because of these defects. What does it have to do with this quick as water, this haste, this impulsiveness? What does that have to do with anything? I mean, whatever, he did the wrong thing. And the truth of the matter is, when you think about it, after the interpretation of Rashi, it doesn't seem like your reaction is, you seem to be more concerned about Yaakov. That Yaakov didn't do the right thing. And then Reuven seems to be acting with proper motivation. He was concerned about his mother. Keep it aim. Honor thy mother. He was very... No, she wasn't erotic. I don't know.
That wasn't for him to decide.
You're right. True, so he made a mistake. I would agree with Lori that he really should not have gotten involved over here. Even if Yaakov... Well, first of all, whether Yaakov was right and wrong, I haven't agreed with your point. You seem all to feel that it was wrong what he did, and that by rights he should have moved his bed into Leah's tent. That's your opinion.
No, that's not
a problem. Oh, I thought you... Okay. So, some of the story of Reuven. Let's leave this. I'd like to just leave it for the time being. And we'll go around, in a roundabout way, we'll come back to it. Let's study Reuven in a more direct way. Let's see Reuven in action. Where do we see Reuven in action primarily? At the pit. The case with Yosef. So let's turn to that story. You know the story. The brothers were jealous, they were envious of Yosef. We've gone through that. And then... they got even angrier. The hatred increased because of his dreams. They thought he was an egomaniac and he was out for power and he was going to destroy them and so forth. So I explained one time what led the brothers, that the brothers weren't just about to kill him because of some petty jealousy that because Yaakov had favored him with the coat. It was much deeper than that. They regarded him in their own minds, they regarded him as being a threat and a danger. All right, but I'm not going to go into that now. But what happens at the pit? It's interesting because the firstborn, and we're talking about being the leader, is expected to demonstrate certain qualities of leadership. And if you read the way Reuven conducted himself in this situation, he did exhibit characteristics of leadership. Now, let's take a look at verse 18. We'll start with 37:18. They saw him from the distance, and before he even got near them, they began to hatch schemes to kill him. And each one said to his brother, "Behold, the dreamer, the master of dreams, the dreamer is coming. And now let us come and kill him and cast him into one of the pits, and we shall say that a wild animal had eaten him up, and we'll see what becomes of his dreams." So the dreams were a key factor, as we explained. If it wasn't for those dreams, then the jealousy, per se, would not have, the fact that Yaakov favored him would not have caused them to want to kill him. But they viewed those dreams as being a sign of danger. Okay. By Yishmaru, and Reuven heard, and he saved him from their hands. And he said, we may not take a life. And then he said to them, "Do not spill blood. Cast him into one of the pits, into this pit that is in the desert, and our hands shall not be upon him, in order to save him from their hands, to bring him back to his father." Alright? Now, that last part is not what he said. In order to save him from their hands, that's not what he said. That's in brackets. The Torah has explained that was his motivation. You understand that? Reuven didn't tell them that. Let's put him in a pit in order to bring him back. No. His plan was, at that point, he recognized his objective. The Torah says he saved him. The Torah gives him credit for saving him. Even though, in point of fact, he wasn't totally saved. He was only partially saved. But his objective was to save him, and he was confronted with a difficult situation. He could not talk them out of it. Now, we know that he tried to talk them out of it. Because later on, when they go down to Egypt, and Yosef accuses them of being spies, and Yosef takes Shimon from them, and they're in a bind. And he said, didn't I tell you, you shouldn't sin against the youth, when he pleaded with us, and you didn't listen to me, and now his blood is being avenged? In other words, Reuven was telling them that God is punishing us for the fact that we sinned against our brother, and I pleaded with you not to. So you see that Reuven actually pleaded with them not to harm him. But he had to come up with a plan. He couldn't convince them. So the plan was, let's not kill him with our own hands, because that's a blatant act of murder. Let's, however, put him into the pit. We analyzed that too, if you remember, because the question is, so if you put him into the pit, you're killing him too. They're not stupid. But I explained that he convinced them that perhaps we're wrong. Let's assume we're making a mistake. And therefore, let's say there is some truth to his dreams. Let's say there is some prophecy to his dream. So we should give the God's providence an opportunity to save him. If we kill him with our own hands, so then God will not interfere with our free will. God does not interfere with a person's free will. So if we take a gun and shoot him, then there's no way. However, if we put him into the pit, so if he's guilty, then God won't save him. But if we've made a mistake, and really he's innocent, and his dreams are true, and God, we've left the window open to these problems. Okay. So they accepted that plan. They accepted that plan. Instead of killing him directly, they're going to put him in the pit. What was his objective? To get him to come back later and to get him and to save him. So he recognized that he had a responsibility to save him and to bring him back to his father. Now the question is, that's pretty good. Afterwards, Yehuda stepped into the picture. Then the next step, and Yehuda was the one who became the king. Where did the kingship go? It went from Reuven to Yehuda, because the kingship belongs to Judah. Judah was the king. King David. David is from the tribe of Yehuda. And the ultimate king, the Melech HaMashiach, will be from the tribe of Yehuda. Comes along and takes it one step further, because the caravan came along, and then he says to the brothers, What will we gain by being responsible for his blood? We're still responsible if he dies. We don't have to do that. Let's sell him. Right? He says in 26, Judah said to his brother, what do we gain if we kill our brother and we cover his blood? It's going to be a problem here. If we have to do a whole cover-up and so forth. Let us go and sell him to the Ishmaelites, and our hands will not be on him. For he's our brother. He's still our brother. So he went one step further. All right, well, he's a threat to us. We still have to have reason to fear him, but he's still our brother. Maybe we're wrong. So he takes it one step further, and we'll increase his chances. We'll give him a better chance. We'll sell him as a slave. So this way, chances, you know, most probably he won't be able to harm us. But at least he won't be killed. All right. So then, I'm sorry, again, it's pretty bad, right?
Pretty bad.
Yeah.
I mean, they were so threatened. I mean,
it's pretty bad that they did such a thing.
That they did such a thing. Like, yeah. How would you consider it better? That's a poor option.
It's a poor option, but it's a better option.
It's better, but it's pretty bad.
So, yeah, but you have to, I'm really, it's a good question. And I gave a shear on this. So I'm really just, I'm not doing justice to your question. I understand that. Now, this is the only... Yes, I made that clear. But it's very difficult to prove that point right now. I'm taking that for granted. We'll give you the arises, though. If you read the story now in context, just on the story level, there's something that should bother you. I have a better question if that's the case. You're right. Why was it necessary for Yehuda to argue it further? True. But then what happened? Let's go on. Where's Reuven? Now, where's Reuven during this entire thing? Here's Reuven. Reuven had a plan. He had no intention that he should be sold as a slave. He had a plan. He had it all worked out. And the purpose was to bring him back to his father. Now, he certainly didn't want to be sold as a slave because the whole thing for his whole... This was against his whole objective. So where was he at that time? Well, why did he run away? Then it says that, take a look at 29, and Reuven returned to the pit. And behold, Yosef was not in the pit, and he rent his garments. So he was in a state of shock. This had a tremendous impact upon him. And he returned to his brothers, and he said, the boy is not here. And I don't know where I'm going to go. I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. In other words, I don't know what to do with myself. He was in a complete state of shock. Now, what's the obvious question? Well, where was he? What happened? And where was Reuven? Right? But Reuven, Hechan Haifa, where was Reuven? Here he is, the great, he steps forth, they're about to kill him. He's the hero of the story. Up until this point, he's the hero of the story. And he argues with his brother. All right, he can't convince them. It's about his war. He can't always convince people. They were determined. But he comes up with this brilliant idea. He was able to get out of the brilliant idea because it had to be a plan which would satisfy their desire to get rid of him, with putting him in the pit, at the same time which leaves an opening. It was a brilliant idea. You see how creative it was. And don't think it was easy because, we don't put ourselves in that situation. Put yourself in a situation. And these brothers were serious people. Once they came to a decision, I mean, the rabbis regarded it as though they had a court. They tried him according to their standards. They had a trial, and once they decided that he has to be killed, they're going to carry it out. These are the same people that brought you Shechem, Dina. They saved Dina. They wiped out a whole city to save their sister. So they're not fooling around over here. These are serious people. And when they decided that he has to be killed, that's it. He's going to be killed. So Reuven came up with this brilliant plan. Having done so, he's now not there. Obviously, he's out of the picture. And he comes back, and he's gone. And of course, he's in a terrible state of shock. He tears his clothes. He's in a state of mourning. What happened?
Well, Reuven
he shows elements of leadership, to stand up against the brothers, against the tides, and then to devise a solution, which was a brilliant compromise. The plan was very good, I would say. Right? But then, on the other hand, he's lacking in something. Well, what caused? You have to explain to me. You can't just say, well, he wasn't a great leader. You have to explain what he was lacking in. What caused? What do you mean? You just fell asleep?
Absolutely.
Where'd he go? I'm sorry?
He wouldn't have to lie to Yakubov if he wasn't there at the scene.
No, but he was going to bring him back. Listen, you have to keep the... Reuben's, according to Reuben's idea. In Reuben's plan, he was going to bring him back to his father. He was going to bring him back safely. What he was going to... We don't know. What we don't know, and what I don't think we ever find out, is what he was going to tell the brothers. What was he going to tell the brothers? The brothers were going to find out. I didn't know what he planned to tell them, but apparently he didn't care. Apparently, Reuben was prepared, because then the brothers would be angry at him. He deceived them, and he went against their decision. But apparently he didn't care. He was going to defy. He was prepared to defy his brothers to do the right thing. Of course, that never came about. That never came about because he lost control of the situation.
Yeah.
Now, my question is, where was he at that time? Rashi. Rashi 29 says, Reuben returned, v'mechirasa lo hayasham. Rashi says that during the sale, when he was sold, he wasn't there. Why? Because the day had come when he was supposed to go and serve his father. The answer is that apparently each son had a designated day when he would take care of his father, serve his father. And that was his day. So he left. Or he gives another answer. Another answer is that he was involved in his sackcloth and fasting for the sin of moving the bed of his father. This is very strange. But let's take up, which means he returned, so it means to say that, but what is this answer telling us? Is this something positive? Is this in phrase of Reuben? Is it trying to exonerate him? I'd like to understand it. What is Rashi's bothered by a problem, which should bother everybody. That it just doesn't make any sense. His actions don't make any sense. Here he is involved in something extremely important, and he's succeeded in saving the life, because the Torah does say he saved him. The Torah gives him credit for that. That's a big... By the way, maybe this is the time to mention that Chazal, that on that sentence, it says, I don't know if it's over here, if Rashi quotes it, I know Chazal mentioned, the Torah says that Reuben heard and saved him from their hand. But the truth is, he really didn't save him. It's completely. It was just a partial saving. Right. Now it says, Vayishma Ruven Vayati Leihu. Take a look. In Tzuchaf Aleph. Vayishma Ruven Vayati Leihu Miyodam. So the Torah gives him credit for more than he actually did, because the plain implication is that he saved him. Gives him a lot of credit. So there is a Chazal, a statement of the rabbis in the Talmud, that says that had Ruven known that just for putting him in the pit, for saving, for the little that he did, for saving Yosef from their hands, but only it wasn't a complete saving, just to get him into the pit, that just for that alone, the Torah was going to mention that he saved him. Had he known that, he would have carried Yosef on his shoulders and would have back to the pit. Had he known that? Had he known that he was going to get so much credit for the little that he did? It's an interesting idea. You have to interpret it. Then, which indicates, they're indicating that he failed. He could have done more, but he failed. And they're also pointing out something about his character. Had he known that for the little that he did, the Torah was going to write that much about him, then he would have done more. But he didn't know. He didn't know. Well, nobody knows. You see, when a person is acting, they don't know how it's going to be viewed and how it's going to be judged. So that's telling us something. Let me get back to this Rashi. What's bothering Rashi is, where was he? It doesn't make any sense that he should not be there. And yet he's not there. Now Rashi gives us two answers. Let's take each answer. Now these answers, are they exonerating him? In other words, now I understand that it makes sense. So there's no criticism of Reuben? Or are they criticisms? Are they intended? It's not really clear from the answer. It seems very neutral. Rashi is just giving us factual information. Either we are to assume that he went back to serve his father. Well, that's nice. Keep it up. He had to go back and minister to his father that day. Does that explain it? Or the other answer is, no, he didn't go back, but he was involved in something else. He was involved, deeply involved in tshuva. So he was a tzaddik. He was doing repentance, tshuva. for this sin. And he was so involved in it that he actually changed his clothing. Whether you want to take it literally, that he actually wore sackcloth, but the mourner dresses in a different way, which is highly praiseworthy. He was dressed in the sackcloth. So he went back, and he was fasting. So he went back, and he probably stayed away from his brothers. He wanted to be alone by himself to repent. So that's a tzaddik. So therefore, he did what he had to do, and he got them to stop, put him in the pit, and then he went back to his fasting. And when the brothers are gone, he didn't know how long the brothers. He estimated the brothers would be gone. Then he came back. It's like he went to daven. He went to daven. He had to do a mitzvah. He went to help somebody else. In this case, the mitzvah was tshuva. So, I mean, is that right? So he's okay? Is he exonerated? Or he's wrong? That's what I'd like to analyze. This thing about the sackcloth, though, who does it remind you of? In the Mordechai. There's another, it mentions by Mordechai that when he heard about the news, yeah, I know that. Well, I'm gonna ask you to compare it to the case of Mordechai. He's giving credit. Mordechai, when he heard about the decree to kill the Jews, he put on sackcloth and he went to the middle of the city and he rent his garments and he gave out a loud and wailing scream. And then Esther heard about it and she sent messengers, you know the whole story, and he informed her about the decree. Then it says that he returned. Now Rehovair, right? After she finally agreed to go and take a chance and appear before the king unsummoned, risking her life, it says he returned. And Mordechai returned to the center of the city. Rashi, he returned to what? He returned to a sackcloth in mourning. But that return was a good thing. Well, this one we don't know. I would say, let's take it. He basically agrees that although he did the correct action in this case, but his motivation, the motivation wasn't the proper one. Am I right? That's what you're all saying. From which you see something very interesting. It's a very important lesson for what's going on in Jewish life today also. That, because people tend to think, well, it doesn't really matter. As long as they're doing good things, why look at their motivation? Oh, to a point, there's some truth in that. But motivation does affect the character of what you're doing. And up to a point, sometimes you won't see it. The effect of the motivation. But ultimately, a plan can only be successful if it's founded in the right motivation. What was Reuven's motivation over here? Reuven embarked upon a great... What would have been the proper motivation? The proper motivation should have been that what they're doing is wrong. That really they're wrong, and they're only doing this even though they had their own ideas and everything. He should have pointed out to them that they're wrong, and it's a mistake, and that they just can't do it. He should have carried them back. See, had he known what the Torah was going to say about him, he would have, but he didn't have the strength to do it. This pasuk itself points out what his motivation was. What did it say? He saved them from their hands. Laman atalosum yadam, to say lashivo alavim, to bring him back to his father. Now that's extra. It didn't have to say to bring him back to his father. All it had to say was to save him from their hands. But it's more than just, of course, to bring him back to his father. That was his motivation. Rashi says that, what did he say? He said that I am the Bechor, I'm the firstborn, and the eldest of all them. He will not attribute this sin except to me. In other words, I'll be held to blame. So really, his primary motivation was to avoid blame. He didn't want to, I'm sorry. But he comes back to the pit and he has this emotional reaction. And he says, he tears his garment. And he goes to his brothers and he says, the boy is not here. And where will I go? What does he mean, where will I go? Ana evrach mitzar shel abba. Where will I run from the pain of my father? Which goes to show us.
He
couldn't tolerate the... Wow. Well, you can learn it in two ways, actually. In other words, you can tolerate it two ways. Learn it two ways. You can learn that he just couldn't bear the sight of his father suffering, per se. But in context over here, I'd say it's more of a personal thing. That he's responsible. He can't... See, he has a sense of responsibility. He's let his father down.
He's always been ineffective in the relationship with his father. Everything
that... You see, Because his motivation was, it's interesting why the two, why it works out, because his motivation was the fear. It was really the fear of the condemnation of his father. That's what motivated him. That prevented him, that very same emotion prevented him from doing it properly. You see, one second, now you'll understand why. Because it would seem that his basic need, his most powerful psychological need, was to have the approval of his father. And he didn't feel too much of a sense of confidence with regard to this area. And that would explain. So when Rashi says that on that day he went back to serve his father, which would seem to be a good thing. He was a conscientious son, and you might think, well, he had no choice because he had to serve his father. So no, that's a criticism. Because a leader has to make decisions. You have to make a choice. So we'll make an excuse. Right now, the important thing is to be out there. You see? The important thing is to be out there in the situation. Now, why would he go back and serve his father on that day when this is much more important. He'll make up an excuse later on. He could have thought of an excuse for his father. His father is not in any danger, so his father won't happen that day. But the point is, psychologically, he wanted to be with his father. You see, in other words, there was a strong personal desire to spend that time alone, because all the brothers were out in the field. He'd have the quality time to be alone with his father. So since that was the underlying emotional factor, that's why he made the wrong decision. He made the wrong decision. And he wasn't there at the proper time. That's the first explanation. The other explanation, just do the other one. The other one says that he failed. See, both of these interpretations agree that he failed to save Yosef. He failed his mission because of a certain emotion. It's just a question of which emotion. In the first instance, it was the very same emotion which motivated him to want to save Reuven, actually prevented him from saving him, the need for the approval of the father. And that overpowered him. The second one is a certain, what's wrong? Ostensibly, he went back to his fasting, to his tshuva. He's involved in tshuva. But yeah, this is, and when Mordechai returned to his mourning in sackcloth, that's a positive thing. That's a good thing. You see, but the point is, this is not a time for mourning. There's a time for mourning, and there's a time for action. Apparently, he was indulging. You see, you have to be very careful with repentance. Everything in the, you can never trust any particular emotion. I mean, the emotion of guilt and repentance has its place, but excessive mourning, excessive repentance, is also not good. Because you have to draw the line. Where is it? Is there such a thing as rational repentance? When a person feels regret, he goes through the regret and shame, but that should prompt him to then introspect, do the introspection, correct, and go back into reality. I mean, but if a person is going to be steeped. A person can be steeped in guilt, so there's no point in that either. That's irrational. I mean, that's destructive. He's simply destroying himself. But very often a person is doing so because it's satisfying certain emotions. He feels guilt. He feels a lot of guilt. So then he's being overcome. He's indulging. It's a different kind of self-indulgence. The only thing is that people don't feel guilty about that because of the painful emotion. But the reason why they want to be in that state is because they want to get rid of the guilt. So therefore they'll deny themselves. It's like a person that sins, right? They're stupid, but then he'll constantly deny himself. Now that denial can be irrational, ridiculous, because as a result of that denial, he's not functioning properly. Right? I mean, now if a person would be steeped in that, that would also work. In the case of Mordechai, it was to his credit, because he did not allow this state of mourning to prevent him from doing the right action. He stopped the mourning, he went to Esther and he acted. Then after he had done everything that he could possibly do, then he went back, and that was the proper state to be in, but not before. Reuven should not have done that. He should have stopped, which he did stop. He had to stop because he had to get involved in the external situation. But then he went too quickly back to the state of sackcloth and mourning because of the sin. That's not important now. Right now you've got to stay with the situation. So you see, in Judaism you have to know there's no, there's no particular emotion which is always going to guarantee that you're going to do the right thing. You always have to use the sale. Everything has to be done with it. There's a time for guilt, yes. A person that doesn't feel guilt is going to be in trouble. A person, there's a time for shame, but then there's a time when you have to put those emotions aside and you have to go back and act rational. You had a question. Is saying that in the case with the bed, the concern is not for the father. It's a contradiction in terms. We're assuming that his primary motivating emotion in life was this need for the approval of his father. He was concerned with his father. However, in the case with the bed, it seems that he's more concerned with his mother, not with his father at all. In fact, that seems to be his sin, that he disregards his father's needs. And here we see the opposite. I'll try and reconcile the two. That's a good point. Before we leave this case, anything else to be said on this case over here? One of these days, I want to tackle that whole issue. But anyways, they have an article on the Rebbe there, on his 90th birthday, with a lot of his quotes. Yeah, very interesting. Anyway, I just got it in the mail the other day. You should bear in mind, though, that motivation is very important. And motivation will affect the outcome. The quality of what a person does, the quality of the outcome will be affected by motivation. It's not so simple. It's not so simple. And eventually, it's impossible to escape from motivation. In basically any endeavor that you undertake, you see it always in organizations, too. People get involved, and they start out, they do. And this comes out, well, in all, how many movements? Idealistic movements in government. When people start out, a lot of corrupt people began to be idealists. You know, they want to do good for society, and they do great things. And then eventually they wind up in jail. Somehow, somewhere along the line. Now, what happened? Well, that's why it points out the others. In Ashes Chayil, those of you will get to hear it on Friday night. What is they? That's one of my favorite lines. I usually say this, unfortunately, at funerals, when I have a funeral. Now, it says, what does it say? Gimalasu tov lo ra. Kol yimei chayah. Right? She doeth him good and not evil. Now, my question is, if she does good, so of course she doesn't do evil. What does it have to mention? And not evil. Because the point is, it shows the perfection of motivation. Now, a lot of people do good. A lot of people know what they're. How many people do you know that don't do good? And even people that wind up in trouble or in jail or whatever, you'll always say they did so many good things. They have done very good things. Right? It's true. But you can't say, well, rough. That's a different thing. The point is that because even when they were doing good, they weren't doing it for the perfect motivation. So a person who's doing good, who does good, can still do a lot of evil. Because the underlying motivation is basically for the self. And most people that do good in the world are not doing good for the sake of good. They're doing good as a means of getting some selfish attainment. Usually it's recognition or a position, whatever the case may be. Since the underlying motivation is a selfish one, so then, when there's a conflict between the cause and their own selfish gain, so then selfish gain wins out. So that person can do harm as well. And the same thing with friends. Sometimes people can't understand how this person can do this to me. They're such a good friend. And they'll point out that this person did so many good things for me. Yeah. But when the person was doing it, it was for a selfish motivation. So now, the selfish motivation demands they do something which is going to harm you. So they can do something which is going to harm you. So that's the idea. But the perfected person, in this case the perfected woman, the Eishes Chayil, is Gemalasi Tov V'lo Ra. That's a different kind of good. That means that she's acting out of genuine perfection. The one that's acting out of genuine perfection can't do Ra, can't do evil. Because it doesn't make any difference. It's not just in this situation. It's not a situational phenomenon. Now, where else do we see? We haven't explained our impulsivity. We haven't explained impulsivity. But Reuven, we've only shown that he acted for the wrong motivation. And since he did, he didn't carry it through to fulfillment. And the underlying motivation was the need for the approval of his father. That was a very powerful thing. Where else do you see impulsivity? Another case. We have the case of the bed. We have the case with With Reuven, there's one other incident with Reuven that I think is significant. Well, well, show me. I have the story. After that first encounter with Yosef, chapter 43. You know this basic story. After the first encounter with Yosef, and Yosef accused them of being spies, and they come back, and they discover that the money had been, their money had been put back, and they get the sense that they're in some kind of a big trouble, that Yosef is setting them up. They don't know, it's Yosef, of course. And they come back and they tell their father Yaakov, and he gets very angry at them. He's very angry at them. Why'd you tell them? Because they said, we can't go back unless you bring our younger brother Binyamin. So he gets very angry at them, and he won't let them go back. He doesn't trust them anymore. Right? Take a look at 35. We'll go to 35 now. It was, this is when they've come back now, and they're unpacking. They're unpacking their bags, and behold, each person, his money, his wallet with money had been returned, which was a bad sign, because it looked like they were being set up. They're going to be accused of stealing. And they all saw their wallets with the money in it, they and their father, and they were greatly frightened, because it looked like something bad was going to happen to them. And Yaakov, their father, said to them, me, she called them, that means you've made me like childless. Yosef is not here, and Shimon is not here. And now, Binyamin, you're going to take? All this will be upon me. So Yaakov is expressing his frustration with the situation, and he's angry at them for what they did. Now Reuven speaks up. Reuven says to his father, both, you can kill my two sons if I don't bring them back to you. In other words, he wants now to move into the situation, and he guarantees, let me take Binyamin, I'm going to guarantee him. If I don't bring him back, you can kill my two sons. Give him in my hands, and I'll bring him back to you. So Reuven is the first one to offer to take full responsibility. What's Yaakov's answer? Lo yerei b'nei machem. My son will not go down with you. Not with you. So what does Rashi comment on that? It's a crazy idea. He didn't mean it literally, by the way. Reuven. Because there's no sense, there's no justice. You can't take this literally. Reuven did not mean literally. And would Yaakov do that? If he guaranteed, let's say he would guarantee.
This is the whole problem. It's not a plan. Ridiculous. That's like,
it doesn't make sense, right?
It's not a plan.
It doesn't make sense, and that's what Yaakov said. Lo yerei b'nei machem, my son will not go down with you. So, Rashi says he didn't accept the words of Reuven. He said, Bechor Shota, who's that? Very harsh prison. But we shouldn't. The truth of the matter is like this. I showed them. This is a foolish firstborn. He says, he's saying I should kill his sons. Are they his? Yaakov from having happened. That revealed the state of mind. That revealed the state of mind. And Yaakov was, later on, who did he entrust his sons to?
Yehuda.
Right, because Yehuda operated in a completely different way. Yehuda said, take a look at Tet 9. Actually, start with 8. And Yehuda said to Israel, his father, send the boy with me, and we will go up, and we will get up, and we'll go, and we'll live and not die. Us, you, and the children. I will guarantee him. From my hand will you demand him. If I do not bring him to you and place him before you, then I will sin to you. I will be a sinner to you all the days. And Rashi said, all the days means in this world and in the next world. What do you mean, I'll sin to you all the days? Which means to say, he didn't offer him anything. He said, there's nothing I can give you. I could just show you one thing. I fully understand my obligation to you in terms of justice. That if I am giving you my complete word, I'm totally devoted and dedicated, and I fully understand the consequences. That if I fail to do so, that it's not you that I'm hurting. I'm destroying my own soul. So in terms of justice, you can only... See, think about this. When can you trust a person? Who can you trust? That's a very important thing. Usually you tend to trust someone who's doing it for you. You see? You tend to trust someone who's a friend, and we'll do it for you. Let's say you have a two doctors. One is a family friend, or you know knows you personally. It's a personal friend. The other one is impersonal. But this person is got a reputation for complete devotion, dedication to the objective good of saving people. So the personal friend or the objective man of justice? The truth of the matter is the objective. The person, of course, you have no choice. Yeah, you know.
I'm not.
This was an object. In other words, I can only guarantee you one thing, that I'm not doing it for you. Once I take the responsibility, I recognize that I have to do it for myself. That if I fail, I'm destroying myself in this world and in the next world, which means my soul. That's the person I can trust. Because everybody is basically selfish, and the good person is the one who's selfish in the proper way. Because you're supposed to be selfish. And you, there's no other way except the Torah demands that you be selfish. You should choose life. What is life? The true selfish, the real good. A person that is selfish in the true way is the only one you can trust. Because that person cannot harm you. Why can't that person harm you? Because they're harming themselves. But the person that, you see, the person that's doing something not for the true good, that helps you as a friend, that's really, so that means they're using you for selfish motivation, like a friend of the family. So they're not doing it out of objective justice. It's because they think that they'll get something in this situation. Oh, but if another emotion comes along, that person is operating on a selfish, on the improper selfish basis. You understand? They're not doing it out of a person that's helping, that's doing good because they recognize how important it is to their own soul. That's the person that's right. That's the person of justice. Because their entire sense of selfishness and self-preservation is tied in with the objective good. And they know that by doing the objective bad, they are destroying themselves. That person I can trust. Unfortunately, there aren't too many people like that in the world. Because most people don't have that concept of selfishness. Now, see, Reuven revealed himself over here. That same feature of, here we see the impulsivity. He didn't mean it, but he didn't even think. He didn't stop to think. Now, let's see if we can understand. Let's see if we can understand. What is the defect, then, of impulsivity? Because that's what Yaakov pointed out in the critique. Pachas kamayim. Hasty like water. Hastiness. Right? Impulsivity. And so forth. That was the criticism. How does that tie in? All we've seen until now is that he had this tremendous need for the love of his father. And that motivated him. But that's not the same. How does that tie in with the concept of being impulsive and hasty and not thinking things out? Now, you can't have that in a leader. You understand why that would disqualify him as being a leader. Because a leader can't act this way. Yehuda was different. Yehuda operated differently. In fact, Yehuda didn't even come up with a plan right away. He said, let's wait a while. We'll wait. He waited. Sometimes a leader has to be capable of not acting. You see this also by Esther. When she finally accepted the responsibility, what was the first thing that she did? She said, 3 days passed. We're not going to act. This is not a time for action yet. The opposite. See, she was a great leader. The opposite of impulsivity. Jackie?
Well,
my sense is, just listen to what I'm thinking. My sense is that a person that operates this way is lacking a certain amount of self-confidence, insecurity. When a person can't tolerate a situation, so they have to get out of that situation as soon as possible. They just can't tolerate it because they don't have sufficient confidence to deal with it. When you have confidence in a situation, I mean, what caused the person to panic? The person can't tolerate the situation, so they act very quickly. They have to get out of the situation. You're stuck on the road or whatever, and you just lose your sense of confidence. You go into a different mentality, like you start to panic. You go into tremendous anxiety. Now, I think that's caused by a lack of self-confidence. Like you really feel you can't deal with the situation. And since you can't deal with the situation, so you've just got to get out of the situation as quickly as possible. It's an intolerable situation. Now, a leader is one that has to have a certain amount of confidence that he can handle the situation. You can tolerate it. You don't have to answer immediately. A lot of times when, you see, some people, how they react to a crisis.
like they go off into like, oh, we you know, they can't distill. They have to answer. They have to do something immediately. They just can't tolerate that this thing should exist. And there are people that say, okay, fine, I hear it, it's serious, but let's relax, let's calm down, let's deal with it. We can deal with it. Now, that's an important thing. It takes a certain amount of security, a certain amount of self-confidence, to be able to take the time that is necessary and to have that clear state of mind. An impulsive person is one, I mean, I'm not saying that's the only factor. There could be other factors here in the cause of impulsivity. I'm not saying that's the universal. But I think that in this situation, he had a tremendous need. You see, he had this tremendous need and this tremendous fear that he would be the one that would be blamed, that he would lose the respect of his father. And that was so, that need was so great, it was so overpowering, that he just had to act. He took the first plan. The first thing that came to mind. Like in the case, it comes out very clearly, that's what he means, this Shote. He's not saying he's a fool, he was a brilliant person. But in this situation, he's purely at the mercy of the emotion. Like he feels he has to do something. So that feeling, that need to have to do something, just overwhelms him, and he doesn't act. You have to be able to put that aside. You have to be able to put that emotion aside. Okay, put the emotion aside. Now use your mind. See, Yehuda was able to do that. And that's the quality. The quality of a leader is that it's not enough just to be intelligent. It's not enough. A leader is tested in a situation of crisis. When there's a crisis, he doesn't run away from it. He's not overwhelmed by it, and he can confront it. He takes it seriously, but he realizes that he can't just rev on to the first plan that comes to mind just to get out of the situation. That need to get out of the situation can cause a person to act very irrationally. Now, if we just go a step further over here, see if I can... That's Pachas Kamayim, the holo. See what Rashi says? You acted with the holo, which means a certain... Yeah. A certain... Confusion. Right. More, not so much fear, but rather confusion. Like totally confused. Disorientation. Like a certain disorientation, a certain confusion. Out of control. Well, yeah, there's an element of panic. Of course, you know that that's an important element in all battle and war. I mean, every general always tries to put the other side, that factor of intimidation, to put them to cause a panic. But once that panic sets in, they can't think anymore. Yeah, in everything, in every area of life. Now let's see if I can tie in with the case with the bed. Let's get back to that situation. We started out with that situation. Yeah, the bedroom situation. Now your question seems to be contradictory, because there he's not concerned about his father. You're right. There is no... I don't... When it says that Reuven did this all to save Yosef for his father, it wasn't for the sake of his father. He wasn't acting because he objectively loved his father. But it was for his own need not to be condemned and to get the approval of his father. One second. Now, in the situation, I'll make 2 points of this speculation. And it goes back to what you said before. You made this point before. Here's a case of pure speculation, you know, playing a little bit of psychology. I mean, you have to be careful with these kind of things. But we did do the story about Leah. And we did say that Leah was very unhappy, the Ena Leah Rako. And we said that it wasn't that she wasn't really good looking and Rachel was beautiful, it says, but we said that it wasn't just a question of physical beauty, but that beauty is another element, and that's a certain sense of happiness, contentment. You know, you radiate, a certain glow. And Rachel had that. Because it says ifas toar, that she was good of form, ifas mara, two things over there, that her appearance. So the physical is not sufficient. It's a certain glow. And Leah, we said, you know, it doesn't say that she was ugly, but it says that her eyes were dim. Which meant that she didn't, and Rashi says because she was sad, because she thought that she'd wind up with Esau. So she was sad. So she was, that's what caused her to have a unhappy appearance. That's a very important element in looks, your state of mind. And we said that, you see, there's a certain element of tragedy in that she really had a need for the love of Yaakov, and she couldn't get it. That's clear, because it says Yaakov loved Rachel more than Leah. So Mizi really, as far as Leah was concerned, she didn't get the love, and that's why every time she had a child, every child she thought, remember we said that she thought that the situation could be changed. She thought the situation could be changed if she would prove her worth to Yaakov in terms of being the mother of the children, raising Klal Yisrael. This would change his attitude, but it didn't work because it was something that it wasn't subject to change. That's the way the situation is. I mean, you have to take into consideration that each person has their own psyche, their own emotions, and they're going to be attracted to this one and not to that one. Two people can be equally perfected, two men or two women. It doesn't mean you'll choose one because there's personal factors involved, and that's something you have to accept in life. Just because we you know, unrequited love, it can be. Just because she loved him doesn't mean he's obligated to love her. Nobody can control that kind of thing. But I would think it's also possible that she thought that the situation would change when if Rachel was no longer there. Certainly Reuven thought that way. See, I believe that Reuven identified with his mother's rejection. This is purely my own speculation. And that's why attitudes can be transferred to children. I think, and you suggested this before, you said this at the beginning of this year, that is to say that it's possible, I agree with what you're saying, that he picked up on this. And I think children are affected. I think children are affected, not always the case, but you'll see that parents are very concerned, especially now at times, to raise children perfectly. Because, you know, there's psychology and then there's child psychology and you read a few books and then you have to... I think parents make a mistake, though. They think that it's always going to the book and always saying the right thing. And it's always how you handle the situation. I'm not saying those things aren't important. But parents don't realize how much children are picking up from the behavior of the parents themselves. In other words, you'll tell your child, it's like the case, you know, like a lot of, sometimes a parent has a fear of dogs, you know, but they don't want their child to have the fear of dogs. So they'll tell the child, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. But the child senses that fear. Yeah. Like you see a dog and you go like that. And then you quickly remember and you say, don't be afraid, it's only a dog. All that is just, dogs can't hurt, the dog is friendly. And of course the child is going to have a fear of dogs. But then you say, well, I can't believe it. I always told them not to be afraid of dogs. They don't realize that what they're picking up, and the same thing, you know, when you're taught in school, not, you know, always do the right thing and not to be concerned about what other people think of you, and you're always telling that to your children, but they see in the house that you how concerned you are with public opinion, right? And when, you know, when the parents are coming over, this and that. So in other words, you're telling them one thing, but they're picking up, they sense within you other emotions. So children, and the same is true with a certain sense of confidence, that parents who have a certain natural self-confidence, the children will pick up on it. And if a parent doesn't have self-confidence about certain things, then it can be I'm not saying it always will. But the most important element in perfecting your children is perfecting yourself. I one time gave a share on that. That's the case of Chana. And she perfected herself. And she was able to guarantee one thing. So it is possible over here. Let me just finish my point. It's possible over here. That's why Tan Elbon Imo, he identified with his mother. He had a very strong identification with his mother. And the mother was being rejected by Yaakov, and he identified with that because he needed the approval of the father, and he felt a certain insecurity with regard to that, and it could be that he got that insecurity from the identification with his mother, and that's why he acted impulsively over here too. He had no right to do what he did. What he did was very, very serious, and the Torah considers it to be as though he slept with because he deprived. What does it mean to sleep with somebody's wife? It means to deprive another man of his wife. And as far as Jacob is concerned, we're not going into that, because we can't analyze each person. It even ties in with Shechina, Rashi says. It ties in with his whole metaphysical life. Every aspect of his life is based upon his pursuit of the good and what he was involved in terms of perfection and the choice of a wife. And Rachel was his wife. He chose Rachel. He didn't choose Leah. He wound up with Leah due to the deceit. And then he accepted it. But that's not who he chose. And so therefore that element of his life is an important element in his life. His relationship with his wife is a very important element in his spiritual life, in his psychological existence. And therefore if you're going to mess or you're going to tinker with that, if you're going to fool around with that, you're going to affect him. you're going to take away from his perfection. And understand now, after Rachel died, it was his choice and his choice alone. He did not owe anything to Leah in this respect. He treated her properly. But in terms of who would be the favorite, that's purely his right. That's purely his choice. And to interfere with that is to interfere with his perfection. And that's why the Torah says that what Reuven did was a very serious thing to do. He had no right to tamper in the area. And Reuven only did it, Reuven was a tzaddik. He only did it because he was upset. He was very upset because of the rejection of his mother. But he didn't act rationally, because it's one thing to be upset, it's another thing to take it personally. So you have to now draw the line. It's one thing to be upset. What son, what good son would not feel the same way as Reuven in that situation? But then there's another point where you say, look, there's nothing I can do. I have to accept the given hit, we have to accept the given reality. But what makes it impossible to accept it is when it becomes your own. When it becomes too personal, and it's no longer the upset of your mother, but vicariously it becomes your own upset. And that's when he acted impulsively. So that's how I would tie, you see what I'm saying? That's how I tied the two together. It's no contradiction, it's all one thing. It's all one basic emotion. You see? Yeah, go ahead.